Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Julia Lee, Professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Irvine, and your host for today's show. My guest, Takeo Rivera, is Assistant Professor of English at Boston University. He specializes in performance studies, ethnic studies, and queer theory within the context of U.S. culture. Takeo wears a lot of hats at BU. Along with his appointment in English, he is a core faculty member in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Program, affiliate faculty in the African American Studies Program and the American and New England Studies Program, and a member of the BU Faculty Gender and Sexuality Studies Group. An award-winning instructor, Takeo teaches courses in contemporary and modern drama, Asian American literature, queer theory, new media, and racial capitalism. Takeo is also a playwright whose works have been staged in New York City, Boston, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area. He's here today to talk about his new book, Model Minority Masochism, Performing the Cultural Politics of Asian American Masculinity, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Model Minority Masochism offers a rich and provocative account of Asian American subject formation, arguing that the model minority narrative has been critically overlooked as a constitutive element of Asian racial formation. To put it bluntly, Rivera argues that those who are critical of the model minority, which would be most Asian American studies scholars, including myself, have consistently represented it as a, quote, harmful stereotype produced by a white racial order, a myth that obfuscates the true portrait of Asian American diversity. This has created an unhelpful but stubbornly persistent dyad within the field between the good assimilated subject, who is really bad, and the bad resistant subject, who is really good. In order to understand the complex ways that notions of the model minority infiltrate assimilationist, liberatory, and radical constructions of Asian American identity, Rivera turns to a theory he calls model minority masochism. A, quote, theory of Asian American subject formation that centers the psychic and affective effects of the model minority myth, end quote. I read the theory of model minority masochism as offering a capacious and nuanced framework for understanding the strains that seem to constitute contemporary Asian American subjectivity, particularly Asian American masculinity, techno-orientalism, resentment, melancholia, affect or affectlessness, and Afro-Asian solidarity. Rivera offers a genealogy of Asian American subject formation that cannot be reduced to the Asian American subject, but is instead enacted in, quote, the liminal zones of human and machine, interior and exterior, model minority and perpetual foreigner, pain and pleasure. Takeo, welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies.
Thank you so much, and I am honored to be here.
So I'd like to start today by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself as a scholar. Based on the bio I just read, it's clear that your work is situated multiply across disciplines. So could you tell us what experiences led you to where you are today in terms of your scholarship?
Sure, yeah. In a lot of ways, I'm a fourth generation Japanese American, third generation Filipino American. I consider myself a second generation Asian Americanist in the sense that my parents were involved with Asian American activism quite a bit. My mom, for example, was peripherally involved with the iHotel stuff. My dad was one of the students who helped fight to establish ethnic studies at Asian American Studies at UC Davis. And they met initially at an anti-Marcos event in that time. And I grew up as a consequence in a household that took a lot of the lessons of Asian American studies and ethnic studies for granted. For me, that was always part of the atmosphere. That was kind of my norm in terms of my values, in terms of how I saw the world. So what was interesting was after I graduated high school, and I went to high school in the East Bay, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I went to Stanford for undergrad. And, you know, this is a place that one of my mentors once called the capital of neoliberalism. And it's interesting to think about how the Asian American population there's a very active activist segment of it, but they were the minority. Most Asian Americans did not get involved with it. Most Asian Americans on campus were interested in things like medicine and tech. And as someone who was really involved in Asian American cultural politics and organizing and so forth, I was consistently frustrated at the lack of, or rather, the small proportion of the Asian American community that seemed interested in the work that we were doing. And it occurred to me that when it came down to it, most Asian Americans had no interest in disrupting the model minority, and were actually actively being that, enjoying being part of that current into standard upper middle class or upper class capitalism. And when it came down to it, I thought about my own sort of relationship to the model minority, ways in which I found strains of that within myself, despite my own criticism. And I started off writing a slam poem, because I was a slam poet and playwright, called Model Minority. And that kind of kicked off my thinking about this that continued well throughout my life. I would go in and out thinking about this topic. I eventually went to Berkeley for graduate school. And then I pursued that as a dissertation and became a book. And what I needed to really get to that point intellectually was engaging with a lot of queer theory and a lot of new media theory. So I have Juan Rodriguez and Abigail Duchosnick at Berkeley to thank for that. And the project was really shepherded along by Colleen Lund and Shannon Steen. That was kind of my journey. I engage with it as someone with a background in activism and activist discourse, and also as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me that you came from a childhood and young adulthood in which you were sort of immersed in Asian American activism and Asian American studies, kind of the political formation of Asian American studies. I think for the vast majority of Asian Americanists, at least anecdotally based on people that I know, it's kind of the opposite. There's an awareness that comes later about kind of these issues, maybe in college, maybe in graduate school. For me, it didn't happen until graduate school, really. So thank you for sharing that. Just as a follow-up, were there certain key moments in your life, either in college or graduate school, that led you to this book in particular?
Yeah, I mean, besides writing the poetry and plays I mentioned, and I quote those like old undergrad writing at the very end of the book. I was really interested. I guess when I was exposed to masochism theory for the first time, it really landed. So you know, specifically with Juana Rodriguez's work and her taking her seminar in graduate school, I became really interested in these counterintuitive relationships to power. And then I realized, it's kind of silly to say this, but I thought about anecdotally how a lot of my Asian friends, Asian male friends in particular, loved cyberpunk. Like a lot of Asian male friends love cyberpunk, knowing full well how racist it was, as a genre, and the ways in which Asians in particular are being seen as being machine-like and so forth. But there was this weird masochistic attachment where Asian Americans, I think, really enjoyed that racist aspect about it. And I thought about how this might have something to do with these attachments to the model minority, this thing that we're being told is a myth by people that I politically completely agree with, right? And I myself, I'm actively combating the model minority throughout most of my life, while at the same time seeing, but no, the material reality is a lot of Asian Americans are perfectly fine with it and enjoy the model minority. So I thought about that. I was like, okay, this is interesting. And cyberpunk and techno-orientalism is where I sort of found the aesthetic anchor for this pleasure in particular. So intellectually speaking, that's where it kind of spun out from there. But certainly I would say, you know, growing up, but in undergrad onward, being surrounded by a lot of Asian techies, many of whom are my friends and to this day, it was just very interesting to see the kinds of affective attachments that Asian Americans and Asian American, especially I should say East Asian, Asian American men had with regards to these harmful quote unquote stereotypes.
That's such an insightful answer, actually, because it also explains like the last chapter in your book where you talk about the video game, right, and kind of gaming culture. I'm going to get to that for sure. But you just talked about this kind of counterintuitive relations to power, counterintuitive kind of understandings of power. And that was a really evocative phrase because it does really capture, I feel like, kind of your method in the book. Yeah. So I love the book's opening, right, where you kind of you narrate this genealogy of Asian American subject formation that begins with this Vincent Chin. We're going to talk more about Vincent Chin in a little bit, but I really appreciated how you put together these, you know, different historical events or cultural figures or cultural works or ideas that A, do not really seem that related to each other.
Right? Yeah.
Or B, offer up a kind of another reading of these pairings that really seem to question the premise of the field broadly. So in making these sort of unexpected pairings or finding these different connections between things that we've taken for granted, right, you interrogate some very basic ideas regarding race and identity. And I say basic, not because your thinking is basic, but because in reading your book, I really realized to an astonishing extent, right, how much Asian American studies struggles with what seems to be the kind of fundamental questions about how the field is constituted, like what is it that we're doing exactly? So the exploration of these things that we tend to think of as oppositional or maybe not so obviously connected to each other really begins for me with your title, Model Minority Masochism. When I think of model minority, I think of a discourse that is rooted in the social, right? How others view Asian Americans. When I think of masochism, I think of an interior subjective experience that's about one's own experience of one's own body, right? Whether that's pleasure or pain. So can you define these concepts for us as you're using them and then explain how they speak to each other in your book?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, so the model minority, right? So again, as you've already said, it's oftentimes thought of as this harmful stereotype of, you know, Asians being exceptional academically, being really great at math and science and so forth. But I think it's more helpful to think of it as something like a discourse or an ideology or a performatic scenario. And I could get, you know, more technical about those things. But you know, I think there's a lot of really great model minority critique these days. So, you know, one of my dear friends is Erin Kuenin, for example, and her book Passing for Perfect, that's a masterpiece. But the way that she thinks about the model minority is principally in terms of she also thinks about that kind of interiority of the psychic effects and how the model minority has affected Asian Americans' psychology and this obsessive need to excel, right? And the way that becomes internalized. And she thinks about these like wonderful case studies. For me, I'm actually a little less, I'm not necessarily as fixated on the question of harm. For me, I'm a little more fixated on the question of power dynamics. For me, the model minority, as far as what my lane goes, is I'm most curious about how the model minority has been utilized as a position and as an ideology to support the meritocracy of racial capitalism in the United States in particular. Not to say that this is the only version of model minority discourse, but certainly around Asian Americans, this is the most dominant one, right? And for me, I like to think of it, again, as sort of a scenario. You have particular actors whose roles are immediately recognizable because of how the racial hierarchy is set up, as it were. So the model minority essentially acts as this safeguard and legitimizer as a minoritized subject for a larger system that is in fact fair, right? So a lot of the model minority is actually about adhering to capitalist conformity, right? Masochism is actually even harder to define because there are so many different intellectual traditions. So psychoanalysis has many different takes on masochism. And then you have affect theory, you have black feminism. I draw from a little bit of everything, but the most layperson understanding of masochism, of course, is like deriving pleasure from pain. And I think in a lot of ways, that's not necessarily the most accurate. I think it's more accurate to say that it's a form of sensation and woundedness and some relationship between sensation and woundedness. And that often takes the form of pleasure, but it can also take the form of moral authority. It can also take the form of a fantasy of omniscience. And this kind of depends on who you're talking to. So, you know, the theorists that I most draw from here are Deleuze and Amber Jamila Musser, who I think has written probably the best book on masochism in the last couple of decades. Sensational Flesh. So, you know, I'm drawing a lot from, you know, post-structuralism, black feminist critique. But I think what's really, really key about what Moser's saying, she's not the first to say this, but she says it very, very, very well, and especially within a racialized context, and how masochism is really an intrinsic part of subject formation. And I think that's what I'm most interested in, is thinking about this relationship of pleasure, sensation, and the production of a subject. And that matters so much for Asian Americans, especially when we think about its ongoing constructedness, right? Like Asian American, as we know, is not an ethnic identity, but a political one, one that is based off of these pan-ethnic connections. Around certain forms of political necessity and advocacy. So, but then the question is, what are the kind of psychic attachments that come when we identify ourselves in such a way, positionally, in an anti-Black world, in a settler colonial world, right? So in a lot of ways, what I'm thinking about, so you're absolutely right in how I utilize a social definition of the model minority as an entry point to think about the interior, right? So what are the effects of the exterior to the interior? And what are the kind of, again, I think about investment, what are the forms of attachment that Asian Americans have with and against it? And even when you're against it, there's still forms of attachment.
That's very helpful. I mean, it really, I think, it's a helpful way of thinking about how do I get to this question, but via this other route, you know, a little bit of a, you know, kind of an alternative way of getting to that question that has been, you know, sort of attempted from a variety of angles in the past. So I really appreciated that answer. along with masochism and model minority, your book brings up a sort of a rich array of threads in the study of Asian racialization and representation. So one of the central themes is this idea of techno-orientalism, which you've already kind of raised a little bit. So for those maybe who aren't as familiar with this term, can you define techno-orientalism and talk about how it informs your reading of Asian racialization?
Yeah, I guess the easiest way of putting it is associating Asians with machines, associating Asians as having machine-like attributes, or thinking about Asians as being technologically advanced, but oftentimes culturally barbarous. And there are a lot of variations of techno-orientalism. Your colleague, of course, at UC Irvine, Christopher Fan, was my friend in graduate school, and he and I thought about techno-orientalism together quite a bit. And the second volume of the techno-orientalism anthology is coming out very soon with Christopher Fan as one of the co-editors. So do look out for that as far as books go. I mentioned cyberpunk earlier. Cyberpunk is oftentimes where we think about how techno-orientalism really had its clearest aesthetic, contemporary aesthetic coherence, especially when we think about things like Blade Runner, Neuromancer, like robot ninjas and so forth. Asians as representing a kind of dystopia of having high technology but cultural erosion, and particularly a moral erosion, right? There's a kind of postmodern schizophrenia, to use Jameson, that we oftentimes associate with the presence of Asianness in these sort of cultural forms. Now, that said, I should preface by saying that techno-orientalism is, in fact, a lot older than that. When we can think about all the way going to, coolies in 19th century Cuba as being referred to as mechanized meat, for example, right? So there's a much longer legacy here than the 1980s onward. But I will say that a lot of the techno-orientalist critique has focused on there because it's so blatant, and because there's something to be said about the rise of Asian America with contemporary techno-orientalism in particular. And I'm very curious about that. I think it's very interesting, for example, that Vincent Chin was murdered the same year that Blade Runner came out. Right. So that is largely coincidence, but it does demonstrate that discursively there's something in the air in this period in their early 80s that is associating Asians with machines.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Vincent Chin. He's, the representation and the discourse around his murder constitute like two of your chapters, right? Just as a kind of background information, like the conventional narrative in Asian American studies is that Chin's murder galvanized a quote, these are your words, liberalized Asian American pan-ethnicity, right? So I wanted to ask you to talk me through that process, like how that came about and why, and you talk about this in the book, why it was a strategic necessity on the part of Asian American activists to kind of portray him in a certain way.
Yeah. So, I guess I am sort of cautiously critical of the ways that Asian American identity formed in the wake, or a particular version of it anyway, formed in the wake of Vincent Chin's murder. But as you said, right, is that there was also a necessity to it. So, we have to keep in mind that this is very much the Reagan era. This is a period in which we've been contending, people of color have been contending with this necessity for respectability for a very long time, since before the civil rights movement in the 60s, right? So there is this impetus to portray Vincent Chin to a conservative Chinese immigrant community, a culturally conservative Chinese immigrant community, and to the media at large to show Chin as a kind of model citizen. So there's all this insistence, for example, over how first of all, it is genuinely horrible that he was killed right before his wedding, right? And also this insistence that he was an engineer, that he was on the up and up in terms of social mobility. What was downplayed was the fact that he was in a strip club, right? What was downplayed was, by most accounts, he did sort of start the fight, right? Now, that said, now let me be very, very, very clear that it's still an atrocity that he was murdered, right? Now, what's interesting is we see this in different, I think what's different about this versus, say, like, contemporary Black Lives Matter, right? Like, contemporary Black Lives Matter, I think we've come a long way, because there was a lot of discourse about, like, Eric Garner was like selling cigarettes or whatever, right? And therefore, but the response to that is, who cares? That does not matter, because at the end of the day, none of that matters as far as him deserve to die. None of these things make them deserve. So there's this critique of respectability that exists today that was not true. That had not taken hold in the 1980s quite as much. So there was this real emphasis on Chin's being a model citizen. And ironically, what that did was reproduce a new model minority framework. And it was a model minority framework that Asian Americans themselves were owning, even as the activists who were called the American Citizens for Justice, interesting name, by the way, right? That the American Citizens for Justice were actually actively educating the community about the model minority stereotype and how it was harmful, while they themselves were promoting a kind of model minority ideology in order to justify how Vincent Chin did not deserve to die because he was such a good person on all these conventional metrics, right? And these are heteronormative, respectable metrics, right? So what's interesting about this too is when we look at Deleuze's ideas about masochism is that one of the key aspects of masochism there is this disavowal of pleasure, right? This disavowal and delay of pleasure becomes part of the masochistic framework. So that's why we have a different form of masochism here, and a different vision of the model minority here, and it's also, I should say, different from what I would say is a techno-oriental lynching. Because, and I sort of make this argument in the book, how Chin in a lot of ways was murdered for being associated with these mechanical attributes. So a lot of the model minority attachments are about reclaiming model minority machine-like status in a more palatable way. And from then forward, we see a new iteration of Asian American identity that is very removed from the radical version that we saw in the late 60s and early 70s. And that kind of brings us to today. So,
yeah. I mean, the chapter was really great because you have like the description of Chin's murder and being beaten to death with a baseball bat, right? And then you juxtapose it with the kind of images and like nationalistic and anti-Asian rhetoric of the auto industry of the time, which of course like sponsored these events where people could beat a car with a baseball bat. And you have that image of a white man hitting a car, a Japanese car, with a baseball bat. So I felt like, I mean, for me, that chapter was really illuminating, not only in terms of like describing the path, like sort of certain decisions or key moments within kind of this activist look within this framework and the kind of limitations of it, as you're talking about, like the very, very context mattered, like that historical moment mattered in the decisions that were being made around kind of mobilizing folks around Chin's murder. So I really appreciated that aspect of the chapter. So I just wanted to, just as a quick follow-up, this idea that you mentioned in there of becoming machine, and you do this really brilliant reading of Who Killed Vincent Chin, right? The award-winning documentary that was produced in the years following Chin's death. And can you just talk a little bit about that, like the context of Chin's murder and this idea that he becomes a machine?
Yeah. I think what's interesting is that idea of mine, it's one of the earliest ideas that I was working with as I was developing this project. I remember when I was working with Abigail Duchosnick, and talking about that incident, which she basically was like, you know, screw the metaphor, right? This isn't just a representation. Like, there's actual becoming happening here, right? Like, and I think the thing is, right, is like, this is kind of how racialization works, right? What the thing that matters most in terms of determining what is real, quote unquote, is that social reality. When these very conceptualizations of what is Chinese versus Japanese, these are socially constructed to begin with, right? So the killing in many ways made Shin Japanese because that's how he was interpolated. And that's how it mattered most to the particular forms of violence and racialization at the time. So when I talk about becoming machine, I'm taking it a step further. Because, you know, as and again, this is the work of the film itself, of Who Killed Vincent Chan by Rene Tajima Pena and Christine Choi, that there is this clear parallel between the way that Chin was bludgeoned and the way that the cars were bludgeoned in these large public events put on by the auto companies and the unions. And what's interesting, so when I think about becoming, I'm drawing a lot again from like Deleuze and Guattari here, and I'm really interested in how the process of becoming blurs the two things that are in transit, right? So Asian and machine become sort of co-constitutive, especially when we look at the cartoons that we see in that film that they describe. You see, like, Japanese stereotypical facial features on the cars. And what's interesting is when you put those facial features on the cars, it somehow makes them less human, right? So somehow making something more Asian results in it like looking less human. There's something really grotesque about that. But it also sort of demonstrates that a constitutive part of how we understand Japanese-ness within this aggressively racializing framework is informed by the machine, but also vice versa. How we understand the machine is also partly understood by our Orientalist fears. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about is the killing Chin in the context of these cars being destroyed publicly in the same way closes the loop. It shows that it goes in both ways. So the becoming machine, essentially, yeah, it screw the metaphor. It all becomes, it just.
Bam, yeah.
Bam, there it is.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you talk about this a little bit in your introduction, like the kind of how your objects of study really range, right, across different media, from literature to drama to video games to popular culture. And I was really struck by the kind of range of figures that you open each chapter with. So you have Vincent Chin, you have Michael Dang, you have Richard Haoki, you have Ang Lee as the Hulk, which was wonderful. You have the Asian American gamer. So could you talk a little bit more maybe about the process of object selection for your book?
How
did you settle on these things in particular?
What's funny is, again, when like way back when this was in its early dissertation phase, I had advisors who were like, what is wrong with you in terms of looking at the wide range of things? But then as I like turned that into a prospectus and I was like making the argument, I was like, you know what, like, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to tell a story. And and then eventually they're like, okay. I see what's going on here. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, I guess this book, I don't consider this book to be particularly literary. I guess at the end of the day, what I'm, if this book is trying to make a commentary on, say, Asian American theater or Asian American literature, it's not necessarily that's not the principal thing it's invested in, even though it is making some of those comments. It's really the primary investment of this book is really in the question of subject formation, and really the question and the question of like feelings and affects and how we understand what these sort of different cultural politics do to ourselves and to our personhoods. And so I guess when I thought about the objects, if I'm to sort of historicize it, like, you know, Vincent Chin's murder really is the kickoff. So everything was sort of 82 onward. But what I was most interested in, most objects in the book were messy. There are some objects I could have chosen to write about that very easily illustrated my point, but a lot of them got cut from the project. Every one of them that I chose, pretty much all of them, with some exceptions, were written by like East Asian upper middle class men on some level. So we are looking at the most dominant hegemonic strain of Asian America, first of all, right? And that was intentional, right? So. Because I'm being honestly pretty critical here, all these objects were in various levels conflicted, or they produced these unintuitive affects, which I thought were that's what kind of drew me to them. There's some objects by authors I have very low esteem of in some cases, but it was interesting seeing how some of the more awful authors, that's not true for all of them, let me be very clear, but the ones who are awful, it's interesting seeing how there are these unintentional things that were going against what they thought they were doing, especially in regards to attachments to Asianness. So, and if you've read the book, you probably know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
If I have anything to thank you for this book, it's the image you included of Ang Lee, which I did not know. Ang Lee actually was the model for the Hulk in his movie. And I think that was a really great moment in the book, just because it really highlights what you're talking about, which is he's the structural reason for the Hulk, right? But he's totally invisibilized within the realm of the film. And so I thought that was just really brilliant. So just to move on a little bit now, you're talking in chapter 3 about two plays by Philip Khan Gotanda, I Dream of Chang and Ang and After the War. And you make this case that Blackness haunts Asian American political and the Asian American political and literary imaginary. So, and you call Blackness the racial superego for certain elements of Asian America. And so I found this to be really, like a really interesting and helpful description and explanation of Afro-Asian cultural production, actually, which in many cases is just sort of Asian American literature that is invested in representing Blackness in some way. It doesn't work both ways, right? And so can you talk about the Black superego and how it plays out in Gotanda's work?
Sure. Yeah, of course, Chris. Philip Gotanda is one of the people I love in this book. So, you know, just to be very clear about that. But what's interesting is I should also sort of preface the fact that when I was in graduate school, Afro-pessimism was huge. Like Afro-pessimism was like really taking off, and I would say like really dominated a lot of our discussions. So I engaged with a lot of Asian American Afro-pessimists, which was, you know, so a lot of those conversations found their way into this chapter, either consciously or unconsciously. And I guess I'm always inconsistent on my terminology. Sometimes I call it the Black superego, sometimes I call it the Afro-Asian superego. But certainly I would say that within the Asian American left, and we think about Asian American studies people, we think about activists on the ground, I would say young people who are just like young Asian Americans generally interested in social justice. There has always been this sort of persistent concern that Asian, like to put it ultra bluntly that Asian Americans are just not as oppressed as Black folks. And therefore, you know, there's almost like an atonement that has to happen for that, right? And we have to sort of recognize Asian, like, you know, our non-Black privilege. And there's this way, but I guess that the, which is things that I don't disagree with, to be clear. But I think what becomes problematic sometimes is the way that Blackness sometimes becomes a little bit fetishized as having this ultimate truth value, right? So, you know, much like kind of like, you know, like listen to Black women discourse, right? There's this like, there, you know, Blackness then becomes this almost like a totem in a way that I think is super reductive and also essentializes the Black experience on so many levels and doesn't take into account the heterogeneity of ideology within Blackness, right? But in any event, there comes this way in which Blackness becomes the moral authority for the Asian American who's trying to fight for racial justice, right? In the chapter, I'm very conflicted about this because I do think that there's a very problematic fetishization going on, but I also think there's something sort of productive about it too. So, because you know, as my mentor Colleen Lyra was right, you can't not engage with Afro-Asian solidarity. Like you have to. It is in fact a moral imperative. I actually agree with that. But I guess the problem is the ways that, yeah, again, it can essentialize Blackness, and it can oftentimes produce these like discourses where we are kind of like hurting ourselves and punishing ourselves really brutally, and sometimes sabotaging one another in our communities because with these types of accusations, instead of thinking about this as an ongoing discourse and Asianness and Blackness as things that are very very fluid. Very heterogeneous. But I do think that Philip Gotanda's plays do a phenomenal job of demonstrating the ways that the Afro-Asian superego does in fact haunt the Asian American conscience, particularly on the left, and that is to say Asian Americans who are trying to reject the model minority. So this is like the secondary mode of model minority masochism here, is this idea that like I have to flagellate myself with the truth of Blackness in order to emerge as like a more progressive Asian American subject, right? So it does produce this sort of awkward dynamic, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciated that chapter precisely for what you're describing, right? The kind of ways in which it's not either all, you know, it there is something problematic about it and yet something productive, right? And I thought Gotanda's plays, your discussion of them really highlight that, both of those aspects, right? I wanted to move on to the chapter that actually intrigued me the most, or that I found them, I had the most aha moments. And then that was chapter 5 about Tao Lin's two works, right? Taipei and Insomnia and the Aunt.
It's Tan Lin and Tao Lin, right? That's the tricky thing, is that you got two different authors here.
Right, sorry. And then this idea of affective flatness. So you cite Jameson's work, right? And you talk about what he calls the waning of affect, right? In terms of his theory of postmodernity. And you kind of tweak that term, right? And you say what he calls the waning of affect isn't an absence of affect, but is instead an alienation from it. And I found this to be such a helpful formulation, right? For thinking about 21st century Asian American literary production just broadly. So could you talk about affective flatness and give us some examples from Lin's text?
Yeah, so again, this is the, what's funny about that, I'm so happy you brought up this chapter because I think this is the chapter that I recommend the least to a lot of people because I think it's also the densest chapter in a lot of ways. But it's also, if I'm being completely honest, the one I'm most theoretically proud of because I think that I'm making the weirdest little arguments. But yes, so thank you for cluing in on that.
Wrote in margin, this explains everything. I mean, it's like a universal theory, and it felt to me when I read it. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say about it.
Thank you. So I think what's interesting about like affective flatness is that it's not actually an absence. It's like it does actually have an identifiable quality that we oftentimes, or not we, what am I saying? But that can oftentimes be associated with like the orientalized Asian who's just kind of like staring at a screen all day, right? So, but the thing is like that the terror, the sort of postmodern terror, is that affect spreading to everyone, right? And you know, and I think there is the kind of moral panic around all the youngsters staring at their phones all the time, even though
that's
cross generational at this point. But you know, but that kind of like but that is not the absence of affect. What it is a particular type and species of affect that becomes racialized and thought of as and that's something that we associate with like the unfeeling Asian, right? We go all the way back, you know, we look at like Vietnam War discourse and how, right? And just like it's like, oh yeah, the unfeeling Asian, they don't feel remorse and pain the way that we Westerners do, right? That kind of white supremacist BS. But that kind of coheres as a consequence of our actual engagement with technology, right? So we see these sort of cybernetic relationships happening. So in this chapter, I talk about Tao Lin's Taipei and Tan Lin's Insomnia and the Aunt. And in Tao Lin's book, what's interesting about Tao Lin is he's gone on the record basically saying that he thinks that writing about race is racist, right? So he's like aggressively... and he's, you know, he's also, you know, allegedly committed some terrible acts with regards to gender-based violence, and also is someone who is trying not to write about race, even as he does. So I think what's kind of interesting about Taipei is part of the interesting thing about this is that he actively embraces that affect of flatness, first through his iPhone and his laptop, and then through drugs. And he oftentimes describes himself as like a zombie or thinking about other Asians as being a screen themselves, which is kind of interesting. Then we have Tan Lin, who I think is, whose work I really admire. And he thinks about how the, so in Insomnia and the Aunt, he's thinking about this idea of having this aunt in this rural wilderness and watching Conan O'Brien till the late hours of the night. And then he sort of starts hallucinating and thinking about his aunt as the television itself. So we have this relationship here in these two texts of the Asian becoming screen. Right, not unlike the way in which Chin becomes Car, we have Asians becoming screen, Asians becoming the flat interface, and thus the interface itself we can think of as having Asianish traits as well, right? for various reasons. So that kind of demonstrates to me how there is, even when we think about our current relationship to the information age and technology and so forth, that there is a kind of Asianness that haunts our anxieties around losing humanity and yada yada yada, but it also demonstrates to me, especially in Tao Lin's case, this kind of unproblematized attachment to that techno-orientalized stereotype, right? And the one that can oftentimes take the form of pleasure. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to do in that chapter.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if affective flatness, maybe this is kind of a question that you know, that isn't so relevant to you, but I mean, because you're talking about becoming, right? Asians becoming the very thing, right? But I'm interested in it as well as in terms of like a narrative style, like the idea of flatness is kind of like, and this is where, you know, that's where I'm like, oh, like that's really intriguing to me, right? That it isn't just kind of representational, well, or becoming, right? It's not even representational, but that it's a stylistic thing as well. So I don't know if you have any comment on that, but that's really intriguing to me as well.
Oh, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm sorry that I didn't like get into that more, but yes, no, absolutely. If we're talking about So with Tonlin, he describes his work as being ambient, right? This kind of ambient literature. That's kind of like his principal objective, is producing the and there is a way in which the style of the prose it produces this dispassionate ethereality. And we see that actually in common both texts, although it's a little bit different. Taolin, I would say, you know, his prose style is it's like, I would say, almost militantly dry, and incredibly matter of fact, and how and almost phenomenological. And how it is completely bereft of feeling or sentimentality, but there's also something very, and not to say that that's obviously original, but there's something very specifically 21st century about the way that it manifests, and the way that it has the texture of doom scrolling.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay.
You know, I mean, it provides a similar effective tone, I would say, in the style of both of them. So thank you for asking me to land.
Oh, that's brilliant. So the last chapter of your book delves into a video game called Deus Ex Human Revolution, DXHR. And I don't know very much about gaming, and I've never played this game before. Bear with my ignorance, please. But this game makes use of classic techno-orientalist tropes, right, in which Asians and Asia are figured as highly technological and dystopian, right? And in conjunction with that, you talk about sort of the Asian Americans, particularly young Asian Americans, having the highest rate of video game activity and consumption over other racial groups. And so I just wanted you to talk about that kind of relationship between the techno-orientalism of the game and then the experience of the gamers, Asian American gamers in particular, and their relationship to that game.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just to preface, I'd like to say that Deus Ex Human Revolution 2011 by Eidos Montreal, I actually love this game. And I love the Deus Ex series. I think they're quite brilliant. They're really well written and philosophically really fascinating. They're just really racist. Or this one's really racist anyway. This installment's really racist. And to Eidos Montreal's credit, I think, you know, their sequel, Mankind Divided, was much less racist. So I do sort of wonder whether or not they were aware of my critique of their game, which originally came out in 2014. There's an article version of this that came out in 2014. So I do wonder whether or not there was they read the feedback, as it were. What's interesting about, so, you know, as you said, right, is that Asians and Asian Americans do a lot of gaming, right? We see that transnationally too. Korea obviously is. They take it way more seriously than the States does in a lot of ways. And you know, I also want to highlight a lot of the work in Asian American gaming that we see from people like Tara Fickle, Christopher B. Patterson, Edmund Chang, Juan He, a lot of really, really fantastic work in Asian American gaming coming out. I think because of the fact that Asian Americans play a lot of games, we play a lot of games, and there's a lot of critique that needs to be made, right? So what does Asian American studies bring to the table when we think about gaming? So from a representational standpoint, it's obvious, right? So you know, here we have this, you know, the obvious techno-orientalism. And, you know, for me, though, when I was writing this, the various versions of this chapter/essay, I felt like it would just be too easy to just say, oh, yeah, this game is racist, right? Which it is. But I felt that what was really interesting, though, was, and this is where I had really put my performance studies hat on, and I was thinking about my own kind of disjuncture between who I was and who in my world versus who I was squeezing myself into, this white male super crip figure, Adam Jensen, in DXHR. And thinking about how that alone produced this erotohistoriographic effect. And what's also interesting is how this game, the first half of this game, takes place in Detroit. And that was deliberate, because the creators of the game chose Detroit because they were thinking, oh, if we were to have a transhumanist cyborg future, we should set it where the auto industry was, because we associate that with large mechanization and heavy industry and so forth. And then it goes to China, and then we see all the anti-Asian stereotypes there. So there was this kind of this weird bookending between the Vincent Chin case and Deus Ex Human Revolution. There was kind of this weird continuity of narrative of relationships between Asianness, Chineseness, Detroit, techno-orientalism. Like it all sort of fit together somehow. But in terms of Asian Americans and gaming, I think that there is something to be said about that dissonance between who one is and who you have to play as, and what happens when you encounter the non-player characters you're supposed to kill or otherwise mess with. Something interesting happens there, some kind of that I think is really fascinating. And that's what I was really interested in, is these kind of like these masochistic encounters with those who are both self and other in the game. Right. And so that's why this game, that chapter is not just a reading of that game, but also at one point I called it an autoethnography, but it was certainly an engagement of myself and my own relationship to this game and how to unpack that, which is a very performance studies kind of thing to do. And I get into phenomenology. I draw actually a lot from trans phenomenology, a lot, or sort of early work in trans studies, to think about how flesh precedes the body and how we have to think about the flesh that we're not necessarily inhabiting, but it becomes part of our motility, part of our spatial awareness. And that in a lot of ways is inherent to any first person video game, because you take on that avatarial form. And then what does that do with race, right? What is that? What happens when that does and does not conform to what you're seeing on screen? And that disjuncture, I think, can produce perverse pleasures that can sometimes teach us things.
Right.
So that's kind of my point.
Okay. Okay, great. Okay. So one last question for you. I kind of hate that academics always ask this question. It's the version of what have you done for me lately, but what are you thinking about these days? Is published, it's out in the world. So what are you working on?
Yeah. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, when I came away from this book, what's interesting is near the end of it, I realized that what I was most interested in as I was concluding was actually the question of ideology. I think in many respects, when I was writing this book, I was thinking about Asian American cultural politics in a kind of broad way, when I really realized that there are certain things that are specific to Asian American liberalism. And then there are other things that are specific to, like, an Asian American Marxism. There are things that are sort of specific to, like, Asian American conservatism, straight up, right? So I guess one thing that I'm thinking about now is thinking about Asian American cultural production with regards to that ideological heterogeneity, and really thinking about that very, very specifically, right? So, So I have a piece coming out in Fickle and Patterson's upcoming collection, where I do another sort of reading of another, like, kind of racist but also great video game that orientalizes in a way that coheres a particular Marxist thought, for example, I think is kind of fascinating. And then I'm also thinking about how Christina Wong produces new ideologies of anarchism, for example, right? So I guess I'm thinking more in terms of you know, really getting into the political theory of stuff a little bit more, and how Asian Americans have actually been doing this work to produce very specific ideological threads that we're seeing manifest in contemporary politics. And we're, you know, and we see that in some of these presidential candidates today, right? And how does that manifest when it comes to, like, not just politics from like a cultural politics standpoint, but from like a kind of a straight up on the ground politics kind of way, like how is the culture production produced that, right? So you know, that's very broadly what I'm thinking about, and obviously it'll get a lot more specific over time, because I'm betting that doesn't sound particularly exciting yet, but I think
it absolutely sounds exciting. And I think, you know, I can see the connections from the kind of refinement or the ideas from this book into, as you're moving into the newer stuff. So I can't wait to read that article or that chapter out of that edited collection. Takeo, thank you so much for joining me today and for talking about your brilliant book. It was a really great conversation. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be, you know, interviewed by you, who is a scholar of such renown. And thank you to everyone who's listening to this. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to hear us talk.
Thank you, Takeo. Bye, everyone.